Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, what is it now? 6 days to go? Happy Wednesday. Oh, man, we're getting close. To be able to vote for your elector who will vote for the President of the United States. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it is Wednesday and Tuesday, the day that everybody starts to, well, actually, a lot of votes here in Oregon. 18% of the votes have already been received. In fact, that number is from yesterday. It's probably much higher already today. Tara Ross is with us. Tara Ross is a lawyer, a writer. She's the author of Under God, George Washington, the Question of Church and State, which could be the entire topic of a whole nother discussion we could have. And her website, Tara Ross, TaraRoss.com. She's also written about this whole issue of the Electoral College. Is the Electoral College obsolete? And I'm sorry, Tara, I don't have. Oh, here it is. Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College, her new book. And welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, I first of all, your news release said liberals are all freaked out. I'm paraphrasing this from memory because I don't have it in front of me, but it said words to the effect of liberals are all freaked out about the Electoral College. And I'm not sure where you're getting that. I, as a card-carrying liberal, am all in favor of the Electoral College. And in fact, I think there might even be something to be said for going back to the Electoral College as it was originally envisioned in the debates during the Constitutional Convention. Let's revisit this very quickly. Give us your pitch on this, Tara.
Honestly, I didn't write that press release.
Oh, okay.
I think there are liberals and Democrats that tend to get upset about it, and
I think a lot of Republicans are very upset about it too.
Yeah, there are some Republicans too. Exactly. I think there's a
bottom line is neither of them understand it.
I think a lot of people don't understand it. I think people's exposure to it was the 2000 election, and to the degree people default on support or opposition, it's probably driven by their 2000 vote.
Right.
But
Al Gore actually won the national vote but lost the Electoral College.
Right. So I think people think that if you voted for Gore, you're supposed to be against the Electoral College, and if you voted for George Bush, you're supposed to be for it. And I think both are equally equally wrong attitudes. Either the system serves us or it doesn't, because John Kerry could have won in Ohio in 2004, right?
Right.
And the exact opposite would have happened.
Yep. And I have to say, I'll say this with qualification. I have not read your book. I'm sorry. I try to read as much as I can of guests who are coming on the show, but it's just been such a wild week. I haven't had an opportunity to get to it. But I did write a book called What Would Jefferson Do about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And in writing that book, I spent 4 years reading about 10,000 of Jefferson's letters, his personal diary, his correspondences, and the transcripts of most of the debates in the Constitutional Convention. And Jefferson and Madison and many of Jefferson's contemporaries were big fans of Paul de Rapin de Toras, who was the author of a book that was published in 1754, as I recall, maybe it was a little later than that, called the History of England, which is referred to often derisively by contemporary historians as the Whig histories, W-H-I-G histories. And de Toras, actually, it's a history of England prior to the Norman invasion. It's the Anglo-Saxon, or it's the Saxon history of England. And Toras, and Jefferson referenced this a lot, and it was referenced often in the debates during the Constitutional Convention. And it's the reason why I went out and I spent several thousand dollars out of the advance that I got for writing What Would Jefferson Do to buy on the used book market, the antiquities market. I actually found it in London, a copy that was published, an original copy, a 1750s copy of Paul de Rupin de Terrasse's book. And I read it. You know, in fact, I quote extensively from it in What Would Jefferson Do? Or at least I did in the first draft I submitted to the publisher. They edited it down quite a bit. And Taras talked about this thing called the Wiccan Gemeinmot, which was the Saxon word for the Council of Wise Elders. And the way that the British had done this after the Romans left in the year 400 and before the French invaded in 1099 was because the island was large enough that everybody couldn't educate themselves about the political policies, each community would hire or would vote for and appoint one wise elder. And that wise elder annually would go to a meeting of all the wise elders, and literally they were believed to be the wise elders, of all the wise elders on the island, and they would make decisions about the nature of the, essentially what you would call today, national laws. And that was the model that was used for the Electoral College, and that's why the electors are allowed by the Constitution to vote for anybody that they want. The idea, the idealism of the idea, I mean, it fell apart after the very first election, after George Washington won, or after George Washington was made president. Immediately we went into political politics. But the ideal was that each community, being so far away from Washington, D.C., there not being time for news to travel back and forth, there not being an opportunity for people to get to know each other, that months in advance, each community would find the wisest person in the community, send them to Washington, D.C. That person with the Electoral College, that elector, would then, carrying the opinions of the people back home, would actually get to know and vet the various presidential nominees and would choose the best one based on their own wisdom. And that was the original envisioning of the Electoral College as described as I read in the debates in the Constitutional Convention, in Jefferson's writings, and in reading Taras. The unintended consequence of that, now that it's basically a political thing, is that the Electoral College serves to protect small states in the United States. And without the Electoral College, we would have a presidential candidate able to basically campaign, you probably know the exact numbers on this, in 12 or 13 states and ignore the rest of the United States. So your turn to talk. That's my rant on the Electoral College.
I mean, I think you're right. There are lots of people that had that idea, and I guess I kind of see a bigger picture of the Constitution in which they were trying to create a world in which they definitely wanted democratic principles. They wanted to be a self-governing nation. They weren't trying to completely take things out of the hand of the people, which I think they get accused of from time to time.
Yeah.
They definitely wanted to incorporate some Republican principles, which is really what you're talking about.
These are small D and small R, by the way.
Small R, right, exactly. Small R, small D. Republican principles just meaning, look, you introduced concept of wisdom and deliberation and compromise, and to some degree you elect people not because you're just gonna, they're not just your proxy for your vote, but because you actually expect them to deliberate and to think about things. And they introduced the concept of federalism, and I think what they were really trying to do is just get the best aspects of each of these forms of government and meld them all into one thing, because they saw how pure democracies in the past, you're right, I mean, I haven't read the Whig histories, but they had read so much, and they knew so much about the histories of so many countries, and they were trying to avoid the failures, especially of a pure democracy where there is no incentive for the 51% to think about the other 49% and right. What kind of impact they're having on them.
Well, and in Greece you had, the E.F. Stone's book, as I recall, the Trial of Socrates is probably the best on this topic. You had to have 6,001 people show up to form a polis, you know, to form a legal entity that could vote on something. And it was basically like jury duty to be, you know, so it was closer to a true democracy as opposed to a representative democracy. And it eventually fell apart. It fell apart from dissent within by the elites, frankly. In fact, Socrates was an advocate of it. He was an opponent of democracy. And which is why ultimately he was convicted and asked to drink the hemlock, because of his role in the revolt of the 400 and the revolt of the 40, as I recall. I'm not sure the numbers now, but the two revolutions, the two uprisings in Greece, the small d democracy didn't work. They were trying to avoid that. They were also borrowing from the Iroquois Confederacy, where the sachems, the wise elders, again would make these annual trips. And although the sachems could not make decisions in and of themselves, they had to go back and ask the women, at least in five of the six Iroquois Confederacy nations, the women made the decisions rather than the men. But they were looking at all these different forms and trying to bring it together. And the bottom line is that the Electoral College actually forces presidential candidates now to vote to campaign in more states and more parts of the U.S. than if we did away with it. That's the bottom line for
That's
me.
That's the bottom line. And I think you're right. You mentioned earlier that it doesn't really operate probably as they intended in some ways. Mm-hmm. But I think it serves the principles they were striving for, though the addition of political parties and the winner-take-all system and that sort of thing has made its operation a little bit different than anticipated.
I absolutely agree. And Tara, if you're a student of history, and I know you are, if you can get a hold of a copy of Taras's book, or just find any of his writing. Very few of them are in print, but there's some that I've actually literally transcribed from the book and put on the web. It's fascinating stuff.
I will.
The Whig histories are fascinating stuff. Tara Ross, TaraRoss.com, the website, her new book, The Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Did my ballot go? Lost my faith in the government when they changed the rules without my consent. Don't wanna be nobody's experiment. Just wanna know where my ballot went. They lost my vote. I made my choice. Does anybody care to hear my voice? They lost my vote. Was that the plan? Nobody knows that I took a stand.
21 minutes past the hour in the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Program, 21. Yeah, I just said that, didn't I? So much for being smart. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Lots of strange news for the day. This, as we say from the wire services, Democratic presidential nominee Barack Obama will use his 30-minute infomercial tonight to unveil a new breakthrough in exercise technology that will guarantee all Americans sexy rock-hard abs, the Obama campaign confirmed today. While most political insiders assumed that Senator Obama would use the costly airtime to attempt to close the deal with the American people, few expected him to include the promise of a sculpted midsection as the keystone of his closing argument. This is an issue that cuts across all voting blocks, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, you name it, said Obama strategist David Axelrod. Everyone wants well-defined, shredded abs. In the clip of the infomercial released to the press, Senator Obama appears in spandex exercise wear and demonstrates his ab sculpting machine called the Obama-sizer. America, you're probably asking yourselves, he says, can we have rock-hard abs? Repeat after me. Yes, we can. As Senator Obama prepared to unveil his revolutionary ab-blasting system, the McCain campaign was rocked by reports that a top campaign advisor referred to his running mate, Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, as a psycho. The controversial comment came one day after top Palin advisor compared Senator McCain to the corpse in Weekend at Bernie's, only less lively. Senator McCain tried to draw attention away from the internecine brouhaha today by announcing that if elected, he would name Joe the Plumber Secretary of State. Joe the Plumber is eminently qualified, said Senator McCain to a crowd in Toledo, Ohio. Hell of a lot more qualified than that psycho on the ballot with me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, thanks to to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. News with tongue-in-cheek. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Carolyn in San Francisco. Hey, Carolyn, what's up?
Hi, just wanted to comment on the Electoral College. As a computer programmer, I actually think we're safer having the Electoral College because you have to corrupt people in 50 states in order to take over an election. And if we had one election, one bank, it would be much, much easier to steal an election. I know we don't see that from the example of what has happened. But if we just change the penalties, it would be much easier to track down that this and this happened in Florida or Ohio and put people in jail than if it was over the whole country. So I
It does isolate election problems, and that's one of the one of the arguments in favor. In fact, you know, Wikipedia has a pretty good summary of this. It maintains the separation of powers. It neutralizes turnout disparity between the states. It isolates election problems. It encourages stability through the two-party system. Well, you know, I'm not sure that that's necessarily a good thing, but that's not, frankly, the Electoral College that's forcing that. That's winner-take-all, first-past-the-post elections. Enhances the status of minority groups, maintains the federal character of the nation, and perhaps most important, prevents an ethnic, or an urban-centric victory. Because the bottom line is, without the Electoral College, a presidential candidate could campaign in about 20 cities in the United States, and if they won those cities, that would be it. Because that's more than half the population of the U.S.
So many of those cities have more population than Alaska, so...
Right, right. And right now, because of the Electoral College, politicians are forced to campaign in at least 35 states, rather than the fewer than 20 states that they would have to campaign in without the Electoral College. Thank you, Carolyn, very much. On the other hand, we have folks who are against the Electoral College. Tim in Detroit, listening to WDTW. Hey, Tim.
How you doing, Tom? Well, those are pretty good arguments for the Electoral College, but I have to go back to that principle of one man, one vote, and I think we have to have as much of a pure democracy as possible. Now, obviously, in terms of minority rights, we have constitutional provisions to safeguard against minority rights. And regarding, you know, the ancient past about pure democracy's collapse, and a lot of that was due to infighting among elites in terms of property rights. And don't forget, those democracies had slaves, women couldn't vote. So we obviously have to have voting for every individual. We have to have voting, and it has to be ensured by the Civil Rights Act. But
no, I agree. We can't compare ourselves to Greece. And that was what the founders were saying as well, is, you know, we don't want to be like Greece. They did want to be more like the Iroquois Confederacy. And like I said, the original concept of the Electoral College was literally a council of wise elders who would decide who would be the president.
Could I kind of speak to that, though?
Yeah.
Okay, regarding the wise elders, I think the assumption behind that, and I think it was even in Plato's Republic, is that there are only a select few who are basically qualified or intelligent or educated enough to make decisions for
right.
it.
Right, it's a conservative meme.
I think we can all, I mean, I think Joe the Plumber, quote-unquote, could be as well-educated, you know, not in terms of specific specialties, but overall, and he could make as good a decision, let's say, as a politician. But we have to have a solid education system. It has to be fully funded. We have to increase at least by $100 billion the Department of Education's funding.
Yeah, all excellent points. Except I wouldn't agree that Joe the Plumber could be the guy. Maurice in Atlanta. Hey, Maurice, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good.
Well, I wanted to know what you thought about ultimately electoral proportional representation of electoral college votes, because that would seem to solve many of the problems that you're talking about.
See, we could do away with the Electoral College if we had proportional representation in the United States. That would be another way to do it. But that would require a massive change to the Constitution, which would require calling a constitutional convention, which would give, you know, some of the whack jobs on the right an opportunity to tinker with the Constitution, which scares the hell out of me, Maurice. But good point. The closest we can get to proportional representation, which is how most other countries do this, and they don't need an electoral college, is with instant runoff voting, and which is the primary, you know, one of the main efforts of the Green Party, and another good reason to support the Green Party. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
You know how it goes, but y'all looking for the cars and clothes, and this other man hope is that y'all don't vote, cause even he know majority rules, keep majority of the minority fooled. Your vote really does matter, dude, and that attitude, government's loving it, so if you're looking for your retribution, be part of the problem or the solution. Really, all due respect, kid, voting is free, last time I checked it, look at he crooked and he connected, you don't vote. Getting reelected. See, I'ma tell them in the style of a rhyme. We can change the world with one vote at a time. Come on, if you don't.
Get out there and vote. 34 minutes past the hour. If you live in a place where you can do early voting, yeah. Charlie Crist, did he ever, by the way, end up getting married? I know he was, when he was running, when he was in contention for vice president, there was talk that he was going to get married to I don't know, get prove that he's straight or something. I'm not sure, but I don't know if it ever happened. But yesterday we had Chris Hood on, who was talking about the voting machines, our voting machine alert. Well, it gets even weirder. Chris Hood laid out how he had been in a number of places ordered by Diebold to apply patches to the machines just before the elections of 2002 and 2004. And he talked about how if you want to flip an election, you don't. All you need to do, basically, is flip the most Democratic counties in a state. He talked about how he applied patches in DeKalb County in the 2002 election in Georgia. And DeKalb County is largely African-American, very, very Democratic in Georgia. It's a suburb of Atlanta. And he also mentioned Broward and Palm Beach. And that caused David, I don't know if he wants his last name used, so I won't mention it on the air, but David sent me an email. He went back and he actually looked at the numbers. And he said, this is astounding. The number of, in 2000 and 2004 in Broward and Palm Beach County, now keep in mind, if these two counties were flipped because they're so heavily Democratic, if you went in and manipulated the votes in these two counties, you could basically flip the state from Gore to Bush in 2000 and from Kerry to Bush in 2004. And in the 2004 election, out of a total of 698,000 votes cast in Broward County, more than 500,000 votes, 698,000, almost 700,000 votes cast, Kerry won by 209,000 votes. That's in the 2004 election. Keep in mind, 209,000 votes, 209,199 votes. In the 2000 election, instead of 698,000 votes being cast, only 565,000 votes were cast in the 2000 election in Broward County. Gore won by 209,000 votes. 209,821. That is impossible. Kerry won in 2004 by 209,000. Gore won in 2000 by 209,000 in Broward County. And Palm Beach County, the other county that Chris, he was giving us huge signals yesterday. He said, you know, you flip these two counties and you control the state. In Palm Beach in 2004, total votes cast, 541,000. 328,000 went to Kerry, 212,000 to Bush. Kerry won by 115,000. That was in 2004. In 2000 in Palm Beach County, total votes cast, 422,000. That's more than 100,000 fewer. Gore, 269,000. Bush, 152,000. Gore won by 116,000. Now, that's in 2000. In 2004, Kerry won by 115,999. In other words, 116,000. So Kerry won by 116,000 in 2004. Gore won by 116,000 in 2000 in Palm Beach County. In Broward County, Kerry won by 209,000 in 2004. In 2000, Gore won by 209,000. In both elections, massively different numbers of people turned out to vote. That is impossible. The statistical probabilities against that are astronomical. This, I believe, is proof that the voting machines were manipulated in Broward and Palm Beach counties in the 2000 and 2004 elections. More proof that those elections were stolen. By the way, we're seeing more vote flips in Texas. Bradblog.com, a great source for this. More vote flipping in Texas by machines other than those made by ES&S. Now, Hart InterCivic and Diebold machines are reportedly flipping votes from Democratic to Republican. We yet to have a confirmed report. Hundreds of reports of votes, of voting machines flipping votes from Democratic to Republican. We have none that have been confirmed of voting machines flipping votes from Republicans to Democrats. Meanwhile, in Florida, thousands of ballots have disappeared. This is happening apparently in the 21st District of Florida. This Republican guy, let me find his name, Republican Congressman Lincoln Diaz Ballart, has apparently hired a consulting firm to show up at Democrats' homes and say that they are there from his opponent Martinez's campaign and they're there to pick up your absentee ballots. And they're going around the county and picking up absentee ballots saying, don't worry, we'll aggregate them all and put them, you know, take them to the Secretary of State's office for you. And nobody knows what's happening to those ballots. Where they're going to, and they're calling people in advance. Oh, you're a registered Democrat. We're with the Democratic campaign. We'll come by and pick up your ballot for you. And when you call back that number, it's the Republican's campaign office, or it's the consultant to the Republican campaign office. It looks to me like a crime is being committed in Florida by the campaign of this congressman. And this just absolutely stinks. I mean, there's the Diaz Ballart is the congressman. It'd be interesting if anybody follows up on this. And Scott Hyacin and Laura Figueroa are writing about it in the Miami Herald. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Steve in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Hey, you were mentioning the Electoral College before, and I wanted to just mention that, you know, it seems unfair to me that if you have a state like Florida that has 25 electors and you have other states that maybe have 10, if the smaller state gets out a larger percentage of their population to vote than, say, the state of Florida, for example, why do we still count all 25 electors for the state of Florida versus the smaller state that only gets 10? Wasn't there something dealing with that in terms of our founding fathers when they were first establishing the Electoral College?
Well, there is a problem. I mean, the fact of the matter is that a voter in Wyoming, their vote counts, I think it's 15 times more than a voter in California, because there's so many more people in Wyoming than in California, so many more people in California than Wyoming, and yet Wyoming gets one member of Congress and two senators, so it has three electoral votes. The electoral votes of a state is the combination of the number of members of the House of Representatives, which for every 600,000 people you have one member of the House of Representatives, and the two senators. So even little tiny states like Vermont, where I used to live, which has 600,000 people, has three electoral votes. Whereas, you know, in California or in Florida, for example, much larger states, those two senatorial votes count for a lot less. But, you know, the influence of that is not massive, in my opinion, Steve. What it does is it basically throws another 6 or 8 or 10 states, depending on how you do the math, into play that, frankly, wouldn't be into play without the Electoral College. And that's why I think we should keep it, even though I can make a very strong argument that it doesn't make any sense and that it's not real democracy. I still think that it acts as a bit of a flywheel, particularly in this day and age of very, very micro-targeted campaigning, where you can buy cable TV buys literally down to the zip code, literally down to the city block. And it makes it more difficult to simply run a presidential campaign in just a few large cities or, you know, large urban areas where it might be less expensive. Chuck in North Carolina. Hey, Chuck, you want to disagree with me on this, too?
Yeah, I'm here.
You're on the air.
Oh, hey. Tom.
You still there, Chuck?
Yes. What I was talking about, the Electoral College also in the book, To the Best of My Ability by Donald Robinson, it's the history of the presidency and the Constitution. And they said that the actual reason for the Electoral College was the southern states didn't have enough white male voters and population to count and amount to anything versus the North, so they allowed them to count 3/5 of the slaves as population. Women couldn't vote either, and that caused that way the southern states still had equal power.
Yeah, and you can argue that a couple of different ways, Chuck. First of all, there's nothing in the Constitution that prevented women from voting, and in the first few elections, right up until about the 1830s, in many states, women voted, and in many states, African Americans voted, and freed slaves, particularly in the northern states, they were allowed to vote. It wasn't until around the 1840s, that the then Democratic Party, which was the party of slavery early on, basically made it impossible in virtually every state for women and African Americans to vote, which is why it became ultimately a federal issue. But the 3/5 thing was arguably something by the northerners to prevent the South, the southern folks, from counting all their slaves as citizens, even though they couldn't vote, so that those who could vote in the South would have a disproportionate vote. They would have a much larger vote. What they were doing was they were suppressing the number of members of Congress that the southern states could send. They didn't want any of the slaves to be counted. The folks in the South wanted all of the slaves to be counted. And the guys in the North said, why should they be counted? They can't. You guys don't let them vote. We let them vote up in Massachusetts, you know, African Americans, but they can't vote in South Carolina. So, why should they be counted at all? And the South said, well, if you don't count them at all, we're not going to be part of the Union. And so the compromise that was come up with was that, okay, you can count 3/5 of them up until the year 1808. And then you have to count all of them. And that's how it got written into the Constitution. That ultimately got taken back out of the Constitution, thank God. It never had to do with three-fifths of a person, but it had to do with this battle between the North and the South. But that wasn't about the Electoral College. That was really more about members of Congress, which I guess influences it.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
What if they are hearing just exactly what you say?
If they're listening to 900 calls, they ought to help you pay.
Soon they'll know your every fetish.
And they'll know Tom Cruise is gay.
I've wondered for so long.
They will know if on his birthday you don't call your Uncle Brent. They will know if you don't call that girl with whom the night you spent. Yes, the White House needs intelligence, but this ain't what we meant. They got the whole thing wrong. Glory, glory, what a drama. They'll know if you call your mama. But they still won't catch a drama, cause it's your
minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Max in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Max, what's up?
Yes, good morning. I'd like to talk about Senator John McCain, the comeback kid.
Yeah, okay.
He calls himself that, and he has been that in the past.
Right.
And he's, in these last days, he harps on it and harps on it and harps on it. But in his other comebacks, the primaries, I don't recall him being this whiny. This angry. Yeah. There was the John McCain who used to talk to the press. Do you remember back in springtime we were reading articles in The Nation and other places about how there were some people were saying that a good deal of the press was in the bag for McCain because
sure.
McCain
that was his base. The press was his base.
Yes. He would, because he would sit for hours and talk to them and on his bus, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But no, the comeback kid was not the whiny kid. And also, he didn't have a sidekick who was an us versus them person.
Right, who was
about,
basically a crazy. Max, let me play.
Sarah now. So, you know, we didn't have all that. There was no cultural warrior stuff.
Yeah.
So that's something to think about.
Yep. Yep. Excellent
Bye.
Point, Max. Thank you. And in fact, here's John McCain on Sean Hannity's show yesterday being schizophrenic. I don't know how to describe it other than that. He says, Obama's a socialist. We hate socialism. And then he says, by the way, we are going to take money from rich people in taxes, and we're going to give it to people who are in need, which I think is what he defines as socialism. And then he says, and that's an important part of America. And then he wraps up by saying, we would never do that.
Let me ask you a couple of simple questions about this redistribution of wealth. Is it socialism? Certainly, it's part of the socialist creed. I mean, the philosophy is to share the wealth. Now, if Senator Obama is a, quote, socialist or not is something that I'll let those theoreticians decide. But the fact is that it's a far-left liberal view that you need to take money from one group of Americans and give it to another.
And now he goes off the rails.
People who have built up through their labor and their hard work and their dedication to the free enterprise system and take it away from them. Now, of course, we have an obligation to take care of citizens in our society who can't care for themselves.
We do?
That's why we have those programs, those safety net programs.
Those are terrible.
Well, you know those safety net programs? A lot of Americans pay into Social Security.
The rich
people.
They
pay in to a number of those programs. So the point is, yes, a society and government takes care of citizens who need our help.
But that's socialism.
That's what America's all about. But nobody that I know of who framed our Constitution had any thoughts that we would take money from one group of Americans and give it to another.
John McCain as pretzel, twisting himself inside out. Go figure. Tom in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Tom.
Hey, I'm thinking of a book I read, 2001, Daniel Lazare, The Velvet Coup, The Constitution, The Supreme Court, and The Decline of American Democracy.
Yes.
makes a very good argument for national elections there. The point about diversity, I think I'm, you know, I'm kind of a little confused, but I might be quoting from his book, that in this kind of electoral system that we have now, it goes down to contests in the battleground states.
By and large, yeah.
And
what he overlooks is the setup. He's looking at the tail end of the thing. He's looking at the final outcome and saying, yes, we get these battleground states. But the fact of the matter is that you have that's where the candidates were campaigning, because that's the way the system is set up. If you do away with the Electoral College, you're going to have no battleground states. Instead, what you're going to have are battleground, largely urban regions. You're going to have the Northeast Corridor. You're going to have the West Coast. You're going to have, you know, California in particular, Seattle. You're going to have a couple of big cities in the Midwest. And that's going to be it. Nobody's going to campaign anyplace else.
Well, that's where most of the population is.
That's my point. So if you pick out about 60% of the U.S. population, and more than 80% of the U.S. population lives in fairly highly urbanized areas, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but they're out there. If you picked out just a large handful of cities and only campaigned in them, you could basically tell the rest of America to kiss off. And what that means is a lot of issues that have to do with, you know, regional issues, land use issues, wilderness issues, mountains versus rivers versus plains versus seacoast issues. None of those things are going to get addressed. There's going to be a narrowing of the issues debated in the presidential debate. There's going to be a narrowing of the interests addressed.
Well, that would remain to be seen, because urban people have an interest in the environment too. But they, you know, some issues that should be brought up, national issues, get lost because you're pandering to local constituencies, and that's all.
But see, pandering,
like high-speed rail, for example, that's one that comes to mind right away. Why isn't that a national issue?
Well, I think it should be. Frankly, it's not a national issue because the Republicans have broken the bank. I mean, they consider that kind of thing socialism. They wanted to privatize Amtrak, and so they spun it off as a semi-private corporation. They've been trying to make it an entirely private corporation, like Margaret Thatcher did with the railroads in England, which destroyed the railroad system in England.
Yeah, but how do you win a national election on a national issue when you pander to specific groups and specific battleground states? Well, that's just my two cents on it.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tom. I think the easy answer is you don't. You have to pander to everybody. And that's what we want in our politicians. We want them addressing all the issues all across the United States. Pat in Charlottesville, we've got just a second or two left. A quick comment?
Am I on?
You are.
Okay. My son had called me the other day about his wife answered the phone, and somebody from this is down in Florida, somebody from the Republican Party wanted to pick up her ballot before she sent it off.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was talking
about. This is in Cape Coral.
Yeah, this is scary stuff, Pat. I was talking about this earlier. In fact, down in Florida, on the outside of your ballot, it says whether you are registered as a Democrat or Republican, so they know which ones to throw away.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
All right, so who's the real socialist in the room? Welcome back to our second hour. Dan Gaynor is with us. He's the vice president of the Business and Media Institute and the T. Boone Pickens Scholar thereof. Business and Media, andmedia.org is their website. Dan, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be back. I say these days, who's the real socialist? I think you could start with most of the people in Washington and kind of work from there.
Well, I think most of Americans. You know, I just played a clip of John McCain on Sean Hannity yesterday saying that it's the American way to make sure that there is a social safety net. And in fact, let me just play a little tiny bit of this for you. It's just this John McCain kind of going off message, I guess. I'm not sure exactly.
Of citizens in our society who can't care for themselves.
Right here, we'll start over.
And take it away from them. Now, of course, we have an obligation to take care of citizens in our society who can't care for themselves. That's why we have those programs, those safety net programs. But
John McCain, the socialist.
No, of course not. You see, the problem, you're talking about degree. And therein lies the problem.
So socialism is a matter of degree.
Well, no. So to make a change, you know, you can help a neighbor to, as a society, you can say, well, we can't.
But John McCain's talking about Medicare, Social Security, unemployment insurance. These are all things that were put into place by Democrats who are called socialists when they were put into place.
Yeah. I'm not here to defend John McCain. I don't spend a lot of time doing that.
Why are you promoting the socialist meme, though?
But the socialist reason is because Barack Obama is promoting a socialist meme and doing a good job of it. Because whether it's him or even his wife out there talking about whether it's redistributive change. Mm-hmm. Now, redistributive change, and when you lament that the Supreme Court has not gone far enough or that the civil rights movement has not gone far enough pushing for redistributive change, or your wife.
Yeah, he was speaking in the context. I'm assuming, Dan, that you did, integrity, did your homework and listened to the entire clip.
Indeed.
And you realized that he was talking about the Dred Scott decision and the 1896.
And then he follows up talking, of course, in general, he's saying he's disappointed that they didn't go further with this, you know, that they got caught up in only pursuing legal remedies and not pursuing legislative remedies.
But he pointed out that the Supreme Court, it wouldn't be appropriate for them to, that the Constitution only has negative liberties. It only limits the power of government. It doesn't assert what must be done. That's up to the legislators.
Right.
But here's the point. Let me get to a larger issue here, Dan. We're talking with Dan Gaynor, businessandmedia.org. Danny, have you ever played Monopoly?
Yes. I've also played Anti-Monopoly.
Okay. The goal of Monopoly, then, as you know, is to end up owning everything and put everybody else out of business, right?
That's the goal of the game, yes.
Yeah, okay. So in a non-socialist environment, in an environment where we have absolutely unregulated capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism, how do you prevent monopolies? How do you prevent people from aggregating so much wealth that there's nothing left for anybody else? How do you prevent that game from being played out in the absence of something that you call socialism?
Well, see, the absence of something I call socialism, there's a big, you know, there's a many, there's a long distance between socialism and some degree of government regulation. The government is supposed to provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. The problem is, you know, the extremes that, whether it's Obama, like I said, or his wife talking about dividing up the pie, back in April when she was saying how, you know, some people have to lose more so that other people can get it. No, that's not the way capitalism works. The problem we've got right now is,
it's not the way unregulated capitalism works. Unregulated capitalism, however, leads to monopoly and destroys
nations.
Where
have you seen unregulated capitalism?
Pardon?
I mean, other than the game Monopoly, where have you seen unregulated capitalism?
In the United States in the late 1880s and 1890s. In fact, this is the platform of the Farmers Alliance and the Progressive and Populist Party. These three parties pulled together and created the Populist Party in 1892. And this was their platform. And this, by the way, was the basis of Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican's presidency. And this language was borrowed for his Bull Moose Party platform in 1912. We meet in the midst of a nation brought to the verge of moral, political, and material ruin. Corruption dominates the ballot box, the legislatures, the Congress, and touches even the ermine of the bench. The people are demoralized. Many of the states have been compelled to isolate the voters at the polling places in order to prevent universal intimidation or bribery. The newspapers are subsidized or muzzled. Public opinion silenced. Small businesses prostrated. Our homes covered with mortgages. Labor impoverished. And the land has concentrated into the hands of a few capitalists. The urban working men are denied the rights of organizing for self-protection. Imported pauperized labor beats down their wages. A hireling standing army, unrecognized by our laws, is established to shoot them down, and they are rapidly degenerating to European conditions. The fruits of the toil of millions are being boldly stolen to build up colossal fortunes unprecedented in the history of the world, while their possessors despise the republic and endanger liberty. From the same prolific womb of government injustice, we breed two great classes, paupers and millionaires. I would submit to you that the Gilded Age leading up to the Republican Great Depression in 1929, which today is the anniversary of, by the way, and the boom of the 80s and 90s are both caused by the same thing, which is deregulation of the marketplace and an embrace of laissez-faire capitalism.
Well, and I would submit to you that that's bunk. to use a nice kind of sending off the really wonderful propaganda hyperbole used from the 1890s.
Well, you asked for an example of laissez-faire capitalism. There it was. We had it in the United States. They had it in England in the 18th century.
Laissez-faire capitalism. We still had government regulations. We still had government. You don't have the concept of complete laissez-faire capitalism is a fantasy. It's like because it's the concept of like one person winning it all and, you know, everybody else having nothing, like the game of Monopoly. It's a fantasy. It's a game in real life that doesn't happen.
It's what John Rockefeller was doing in the
1890s. What we've got right now is, of course, we've had massive amounts of government intervention. We have government intervention with the Fed. We have government intervention with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, mandating what mortgages you should be submitting, who you should be giving mortgages to, setting all sorts of rules and guidelines. That's not laissez-faire capitalism.
That's government corrupted by Phil Graham. I mean,
that's government corrupted.
You know, that's government corrupted by Alan Greenspan.
Washington, including Chris Dodd, Barney Frank, and others.
I will give you that there is blame to spread around, but the bottom line is that the things that happened, and frankly, I don't think that those are the things that are responsible for this crisis.
I think there are a lot of things responsible for this crisis, and I think
But the bottom line is it's deregulation at its core. But let's get back to the issue of spreading the wealth around. Do you really think that William McGuire, the head of the second largest health insurance company in the United States, that there is anything that man could do that's worth $200,000 an hour?
I think there's a lot of things a guy who's head of a company can do to
make worth $200,000 an hour.
That's ultimately up to the taxpayers. I mean, that's the stockholders.
It wasn't up to the taxpayers.
I don't own stock in the company, so it's not up to me.
Even if you did, I would submit to you that that company is so large that you would have functionally no say.
Well, I mean,
These have become kingdoms, these corporations. Dan, we're at the cancer stage of capitalism. This is the end stage of monopoly.
You know, I've made the choice when I buy the stock that basically I'm supporting. If I know that he's earning this and I don't like it and I don't think I chance to vote, you vote with your money. That's one of the ways you vote.
That's not democracy, Dan.
For instance, because everybody loves to beat up on the previous head of Exxon, how much money he got, which oddly enough, a lot of it was he got it in stock options because he helped make a merger of Exxon and Mobil happen. Lee Raymond helped bring together a merger. Mergers typically for big businesses fail. That's just the way it happens. Ends up costing companies millions or billions, depending on the size of the company, and could set back a company years or decades. In that case, the merger succeeded and the company profited.
Right. This is Lee Raymond walking away with $400 million on top of the hundreds of millions of dollars that he made before that. The guy who bears an eerie resemblance to Fat Bastard from those movies. Here's Lee Raymond, walking away with hundreds of millions of dollars because basically he was able to move paper around. Now, he wasn't producing anything of wealth.
No, basically.
This is a guy who, with his labor, did absolutely nothing.
He pulled off something that, in most business,
he was part of a small crony elite that had basically bribed the government of the United States and helped install oil men as president, vice president, and secretary of state.
He merged two companies together.
Violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act.
It's not a violation if you're not charged with it. Nobody can.
Right, and that's why he made sure that he had Republicans in office who wouldn't enforce the law.
ExxonMobil is, I think, the 17th largest
ExxonMobil is larger than the 50 largest. If it was a country, it would be among the 100 largest economies. It would be one of the top 50.
There's 16 larger oil companies alone in the world bigger than ExxonMobil. That's ludicrous.
All righty, Dan Gaynor, businessandmedia.org. You can read all about it there. Dan, thanks for dropping by.
Bye.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. I mean, just a second while I close the computer window here. Bill O'Reilly, can we arrest Obama spokesman Bill Burton for being mean to Megyn Kelly? Oh, there's that window again. I thought Megyn Kelly actually held her own really well. In fact, I was telling Louise about it yesterday. I was interviewed by her on Sunday on Fox News, and on Monday. And this is a woman who knows how to take names and kick ass from her side. And I thought she did a good job of representing her side. I thought that Bill Burton did a great job of representing Obama's side, and it was simply a good debate. But you've got Bill O'Reilly going hysterical about it. Meanwhile, Ari Fleischer asked, you know, a simple question by Larry King. This is enlightening.
Quick question, Ari Fleischer. It's a blog question from Amika, who writes, how would a McCain administration be different to Bush's on foreign and economic policies?
Well, you know, on foreign policy, number one, John McCain will be a powerful supporter of Israel, just as George Bush was. So I'm going to go right to that where there's an agreement. I really have
different.
A lot of worries. Yeah, but I want to make this point, Larry, because at the first Democrat debate, Barack Obama was asked to name America's three most important allies. He didn't even name Israel as one of the three most important. So when it comes to that, to turn the question around, I really do worry about where Barack Obama is going to be on a very important foreign policy issue.
How's he different than Bush?
And that is America's relation with the only democracy in the Middle East, Israel. On domestic issues, you know, John McCain, global warming, has always opposed George Bush. John McCain voted against George Bush's tax cuts. He's got a pretty consistent message of taking on the Bush administration. And on foreign policy, of course, he demanded that Donald Rumsfeld be fired. He was the first to say so.
Okay, all right. Well, it's a start, I guess. It's a start. There's some small efforts. It's incredible. And Mitch McConnell is calling on Stevens to resign now, Senator Ted Stevens. What happens if Ted Stevens resigns and Sarah Palin appoints herself to replace him the day after the election, assuming that she doesn't lose, or assuming that she does lose, rather? What do you think? I don't know. It's an interesting one. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Marshall in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Marshall, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing? I was just listening to your previous callers. And it prompted me to call in, but the lady said I only had a few minutes. So I just wanted to say this and make a comment, I guess, about the direction that I take personally when I make a decision about who to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, almost always, I mean, I can always say I generally try to vote pro-life. And this is the reason from this perspective that our country, as a nation, we say that we're a nation under God in our Pledge of Allegiance. That's been brought out more lately with Mr. Obama making speeches and stuff and having the Pledge of Allegiance, the flag, and all this kind of stuff. Our country claims to be a Christian nation of a higher percent of probably than 86% people say that they believe in God. But yet we still have abortion on demand is one of the biggest issues probably that would keep God's blessings from flowing onto America the way that we could have them.
I understand your position, and to some extent, I actually don't disagree with it. But we've always had abortion on demand. The question
we
have always had abortion on demand. I'm old enough to remember when I was in high school, people that I knew getting abortions. They were illegal. And I know a girl in my high school class who died from sepsis from an illegal abortion. But you can get abortions. We've always had abortion on demand. Here's the question, Marshall. If you look at the policies of Democratic versus Republican administrations over the last 100 years, what you will see is that when Democrats are in office and there is support for families, there is support for adoption, there is comprehensive sex education, including birth control education, that the number of abortions goes down. And when Republicans are in office, the number of abortions goes up. Now, whether that's reported during the time that abortion was illegal, pre-73, whether those were reports of women showing up in hospital emergency rooms as a result of botched abortions, or post-73, whether that's actual numbers from abortion clinics, Democrats reduce the number. This is why there's an entire website on this, prolifeobama.com, where the pro-life movement is embracing the Obama candidacy because Barack Obama has explicitly and directly said You know, nobody wants an abortion. We are all generally and philosophically opposed to the idea of abortion, broadly speaking, and it is a terrible decision for somebody to have to make, and what we need to do is reduce the number of abortions in America, and that's how you do it.
Well, let me say this. Two wrongs never make a right. And the fact is that
supporting women in adoption is not a wrong, Marshall.
No, I didn't say no, I'm all for adoption. I support adoptions, and I believe more.
But the Republicans don't. They slash money for those things. John McCain has voted to slash money for women who need help. John McCain has voted to slash these social programs. He calls them socialism.
Well, when Obama says that he's going to reverse he's going to change the law or make sure that the law of Roe versus Wade stays in place and always give the right to the mother to continue to make a decision, you know, to be able to murder a baby. Now, you have to decide this first, I guess, is whether or not you believe abortion is murder. If you don't believe abortion is murder, then you probably won't see it in the same perspective.
Well, that's the big challenge, Marshall, is at what point does abortion become murder? Is it the first day or is it the first?
If you leave the baby alone, the baby will be born because once after conception, that baby's going to grow in 9 months. It will be born.
I understand and I agree with you. Marshall, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. I'm really not trying to cut you off on the issue, but, you know, it's the tyranny of the clock. We do need to have a question, though, in this country about when life begins.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. I got two of these for you. This in Romania, a man has put his 25-year-old wife up for sale in a website specializing in used cars. Alex Cretu, 20, who lives in Bucharest, hoped to get around £4 million, but has lowered his price to £3,000 for quick sale. His ad reads, wife for sale, model 1983, good condition, full option, nice suspension, spacious boot, second owner. Price is negotiable, comes with 3-year-old and 5-year-old accessories, seriousness demanded. He said he placed his ad on the site partly because he got fed up with his wife nagging him. He says he waited until his wife left for a job in Spain so she wouldn't know about the sale. He's received a number of offers, but none were acceptable so far, as the potential purchasers either offered too low a price or wanted to buy her in installments. That's number one. And here's number two. A Polish driver, there's perhaps a cautionary tale in here. Be careful of those satellite navigation systems you can buy for your car. You know, some of them are like really, really cheap. Polish driver steered his minibus straight into a lake after his sat-nav told him to. Stunned police got a frantic call from the bus driver as he called from the Mercedes van screaming that he and his two passengers were drowning. Yep. He followed his GPS right into the lake. Oh, man. Now, that's somebody who, if he lived in the United States, would be voting for John McBush. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Guy in Hollywood, Florida, listening on Wins. Hey, Guy, what's up?
Yeah, I wanted to respond quickly to that last gentleman that called in on the Roe versus Wade. You know, that's worked for years because it's what America wants. And, you know, to me, these deeply religious right people, if you talk longer to that gentleman, I'll bet he backed Bush. And in my opinion, I wish a lot of these deeply religious right people would go on vacation on November 4th, maybe go over to Iraq and take a vacation now that McCain says it's so nice over there.
Yeah.
But,
I'm inclined not to take a cheap shot at him, but instead suggest that he go to Matthew25.org or ProLifeObama.com. These two websites, the Matthew 25 Network, which is, an extraordinary, great Christian network, has, you know, put together this website, the Matthew 25 Network, and the ProLifeObama.com websites, and get information about, if you're serious about reducing the number of abortions, then do what Democrats do. Prevent unwanted pregnancies. It's really quite straightforward. and also make it easier, you know, get us all involved in these socialist programs of supporting adoption. These are things that we can, and frankly, in my opinion, we should be doing. So, Stan in Jacksonville, Florida, listening to FM 105.7. Hey, Stan.
This is Stan. I want to reinforce what the last gentleman said, too, as we feed back. One thing that people who, these out-of-touch anti-abortion people, I can sympathize with them, but something they should remember or understand, and you and I have perhaps remember the old days. Modern-day back-alley abortions are basically self-induced with medication.
Well, sometimes they're done by quack doctors, or sometimes right, they're done by a friend with a coat hanger. I mean,
right, a coat hanger is a little obsolete in many cases. You can go to the web. Anybody can go on the web and get information on what chemicals, shall we say, women can take to cause contractions. The key to it is wanting to make, and these people want to make abortion a crime, they would have to address directly what no one, including these people, has ever wanted to do in the past, which is the pregnant woman is the abortionist, especially if she does it herself. If you want to make it a crime, you've got to make her the criminal, and none of these people, past or present, ever want to talk about that.
That's a good point, Stan. In fact, you know, when I was doing this show from the Republican National Convention 4 years ago, or four and change years ago, I had a guy with all these anti-abortion buttons sitting down opposite me, and I want to be on the record, just like the ProLifeObama.com folks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not an advocate of abortion.
Sure.
I'm just not an advocate of putting people in prison around this issue.
Right. Reduce.
I don't know anybody who is pro-abortion.
Right.
We need to reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies. But anyhow, this guy sits down opposite me, and I said, if abortion is murder and hiring somebody to commit an abortion is hiring murder, that's a capital crime in most states. And he said, yeah, I agree. And I said, so do you think that women who go to see a doctor to have an abortion, even in the first, you know, weeks of a pregnancy, should they be put to death by a firing squad, by hanging, or by lethal injection? And with a totally straight face, this guy said to me, it's up to the state.
Don't know. Well, I know you have a lot of callers. Two things. I wanted to compliment you on Southern Music. You're getting a lot of listeners in Jacksonville, Florida, I hope you notice.
Yeah, we are.
In fact,
we're
very pleased
to be there.
What they have now is a three-station FM system, which covers Jacksonville, St. Augustine, and Folkestone, Georgia. So you're getting a lot of play in all the greater market down here. But I'd like to...
I'm glad you like the music. My wife, Louise, actually, is in charge.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd like to see us a little different music. Once in a while, you got to use Ann Feeney.
Okay. Well, pass that along to Louise. Her email contact, by the way, is on our website.
Well, she's up. Ann is a professional friend of mine, so you understand. It's not just coincidental. But she's up in Ohio and Pennsylvania right now working for the Obama campaign.
Good
she's never done national politics like that. This isn't a woman most listeners may not know the name, Ann with an E, Feeney. You can call her up on the web. But she's an international-level musician and political activist, international. Yeah. And she's been, you know, she's good enough to play Union Halls in Jacksonville, Florida, which she's done. And she's also good enough to be campaigning for Obama. Finally, last thing I'd like to mention is you yesterday talked about the story. You know, FDR, you know, had a story, and we need to have a new story. One of the things you pointed out in passing, I think, was Bill Clinton blew it, put it mildly. Bill Clinton did not create a new story.
He embraced the Reagan story.
He had a chance and he blew it.
Yeah, in my humble opinion, I agree. And that's where I'm looking forward to seeing a new story come out of the Obama administration. Thanks a lot for the call, Stan. Ken in Dallas, Texas, listening on Rational Radio, 50,000 watts there in Dallas. Hey, Dan. Or Ken.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just great.
It's a pleasure to listen to you, man.
Thank you. Look here,
I want to make a couple of comments, and I want to throw something out at you. Getting back to the guy that was talking about Roe vs. Wade, those are emotional issues that the right throws out there when was hanging in the balance.
I think these are becoming non-issues. Like I said, there is an entire pro-life movement that is forming around Barack Obama's candidacy.
Right. Another thing I want to say, there's a lot of talk about income redistribution. It's not income redistribution. It's income tax reform. For instance, why is somebody that makes $100,000 in the stock market and they pay 15% capital gains tax? You make $100,000 from the sweat of your brow, and you're paying 35% upwards. How can you get ahead? You'll never get ahead because you got an unfair system. All Obama wants to do is reform the tax codes and take the AGI, give the middle class a break on the AMT tax.
Right.
Not many people may make $100,000, and they're worried about somebody's going to take somebody's money. But
I know it is downright bizarre that you've got people across the United States who are making $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year. The median income in the United States is between $49,000 and $51,000, depending on whose numbers you're using, and they're worried that the taxes on millionaires and billionaires are going to be increased. That is how much Stockholm syndrome the American people are experiencing, because you've got millionaires like Grover Norquist, millionaires like Ralph Reed, billionaires like Bill Frist, multimillionaires like George Bush and Dick Cheney out there promoting these memes, millionaires like the news anchors and all of the networks. They are all millionaires. All of these guys basically promoting the idea, well, he's going to raise taxes. Well, yeah, he's going to raise your taxes, millionaires. He's not going to raise the taxes of people who are not millionaires. It's that simple. So, you know, get over it. Get past it. David in Keene, New Hampshire. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi. I was just going to refer to how the Republicans were complaining about the jet being used to go to his grandmother's house. This is what I want to say. All they do is paint him as like this terrorist, cavorting with terrorists, throwing, like, totally emphasizing his name, Hussein, like, that's so horrible. By the way, it means good looking. And, yeah. Just all that kind of stuff. And these Nazis coming after him. And my only conclusion is they want him to take, like, a smaller airline or whatever to get a better shot at him.
Well, I'm not, you know, David, I'm not gonna go there. But I do agree with you. It's a cheap shot. By the way, prolifeobama is .com. Matthew 25 is .org. If I misspoke, I apologize. Apparently I did, according to Sean here. Let's see here. David and Albert, and thanks for listening to our newest station in Keene, New Hampshire. I'm sorry I don't have the call letters right in front of me, but we're very pleased to be on the air there as well. David in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, David, listening on KABQ.
Hey, Tom, so many issues, so little time.
I agree.
That abortion caller had mentioned that we're a Christian nation. Our founding fathers went out of their way to say we're not a Christian nation.
No, I, you know, there were so many things that I could have. you just have to pick your battles.
But what I'm really calling about is a comment you made on Monday about a 95 IQ person growing up to be president.
Right.
Or, you know,
no, the comment that I, well, I made a joke the other day about George W. Bush having an IQ of 95, but my argument was
exactly
if somebody doesn't have the intellectual equipment by accident of birth to go to college. And they're going to spend their lives as a manual laborer. Shouldn't good, honest manual laborer be rewarded with enough money to be able to raise a family?
Oh, absolutely.
That was my argument. And I had a conservative on who was saying, no, if somebody doesn't go to college, screw them.
So I'm attacking you for a joke?
Yeah, actually. Yeah. And you must have heard the tail end of the thing because I, you know, then I said, you know, I shouldn't pick on people who have IQs of 95. One of them became president. But my original argument, I had this conservative on, and he says, you know, people who are making minimum wage are just lazy. And I said, no, some people who are making minimum wage just don't have the intellectual equipment to become scientists, you know, for example. I mean, by accident of birth. And what's wrong with honoring good, honest labor? I think it should be part of America, too. And we should have minimum wage laws that say, hey, if you work by the sweat of your brow, we honor that as well.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Our infrastructure's eroding, so what if levees break? For disasters, we're not ready. Bush thinks we'll just eat cake, 'cause a dollar is his true god. The people he'll forsake, business will carry on. Glory, glory, Halliburton.
The company was almost bankrupt when Dick Cheney became vice president. Halliburton, honest to God, Halliburton was probably within a year of going bankrupt. And now they're a multi-billion-dollar corporation that has moved their headquarters to Dubai. They're no longer even an American company, yet we're continuing to pass billions of dollars along to them. Let me correct myself a third time. I got this wrong. The pro-life site that is put together by the Matthew 25 Network, Matthew25.org, is called Pro-Life Pro ProLifeObama.com. The ProLifeObama.com site has been hijacked by a right-wing group. ProLife, ProObama. Two pros. ProLife, ProObama.com is the website. Be sure to check that out.
Baby, take off your coat.
Uh-oh. Our full Monty alert.
Real slow.
Yeah, Michigan Democrats trying to arouse interest in absentee voting.
Baby, take off your shoes.
Might have overdone it on the arouse interest part.
Yeah, I'll take your shoes.
They misprinted their phone number for a campaign hotline. It goes right to a phone sex line. Not a good plan. Here, this is a little more serious. You know, the ballad Lady in Red? Well, the researchers at the University of New York, Rochester, New York, five psychological experiments that they did on a number of women and men, and they found that when women are wearing red, men find them more attractive, both physically, sexually, and intellectually, apparently. They did research to see whether a group of women were similarly more attracted to women shown against a red backdrop or wearing red than a background of different color. They were not. So this is apparently a response unique to men, but might explain why Sarah Palin is wearing red so often these days. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
I'm wearing a red sweater.
Well, you're a very attractive woman, so it makes sense. Look out for the men around you today, Victoria.
Oh, watch out.
Yeah, so how's everything going in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, everything is just peachy here in Washington, D.C. The president met with the head of the Kurdistan Regional Authority, I believe is the correct title.
Mm-hmm.
And they congratulated each other on life, the universe, and everything.
What do you think the chances are that Kurdistan will declare independence of Iraq and then Turkey will invade Kurdistan in the next year or two?
I don't think it's likely in the next year or two that stretches out a little bit. I think that's a possibility. I don't think that Kurdistan is foolish. I mean, I think Kurdistan knows that to declare independence is risky, but it also has its oil, and so that could make it bold.
Have they secured Mosul? Really, the northernmost major city in Iraq is right on the southern border of Kurdistan, and there's been a big fight, as it were, both firefights and political fights over the last 4 years over whether Mosul, correct me if I'm wrong in the city, I'm pretty sure that's it though, whether it should be considered part of Kurdistan or not?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. And I may even have the city wrong, but in any case, I know there's a major city up there in the north. Well, that's interesting. What else is going on?
Well, the other things that are going on, obviously, we've got Barack Obama's infomercial coming up tonight, and that's mm-hmm. clearly something that everybody is talking about.
What's your bet on what he's going to? We had an Andy Borowitz, tongue in cheek alert that he's going to roll out an ab machine. You know, I mean, it's a 30-minute infomercial.
make some money. Time to fill.
Right, make some money for the campaign. You know, you too can have ripped abs. Seriously, I mean, what should the drinking game be? And what do you think he's going to do with these 30 minutes?
Well, he apparently is going to have some kitchen table time with some families, and they're going to talk about, you know, struggling to make it and the economy and that kind of thing. So he's going to be doing some of that. He's not going to be sitting there too much and speaking to us, although I don't think that's such a bad idea. And then towards the end of the infomercial, they will be going to him live.
Oh, interesting. I was hoping that will make it interesting. That will hold viewers. In fact, they might even want to do that throughout, you know, cut to him live and then go back to the recorded parts.
I would think they should do that earlier rather than later in the infomercial.
Yeah.
Now, the big question that's being asked is, because he's campaigning tonight with President Clinton, is will President Clinton appear on the infomercial, or would that be a mistake because he's going to out Clinton Obama?
Yeah. That's a tough one. If I were a campaign advisor, I'd have to sit down with Bill Clinton and discuss that first. You know,
it's a very, very tough call because Clinton has a lot of star power, but Barack Obama has his own star power.
But it's mighty tough to put a collar around Bill Clinton. You know, or put a leash on him or whatever the phrase is.
And he would be going live, and you have no idea what he's going
to
do.
And he'd have to be on a short leash. I'm hoping for a fireside chat kind of moment. You know, Franklin Roosevelt was so good at sitting down with the American people and saying, okay, let me tell you what the Republicans have done for the last 30 years and how badly they've ruined this country, and here's why. And introducing concepts. I mean, I played some clips of him yesterday talking about how the Republican propaganda against him, you know, calling him a socialist, was, to quote Roosevelt, pure undiluted poison for democracy. And you know, these kinds of just coming back and saying, here's what's really going on. I really think we need some fireside moments. I'm sorry. We could use some fireside theater moments, too. We need Phil Proctor, helping Barack Obama.
You know, that's a very good point. I would be surprised if he doesn't do something like that. He has to create an intimate atmosphere. Apparently, the undecided voter is an older white woman who is economically strapped.
Hmm.
And that's who both McCain and Obama need to go after.
Right.
And you do that by appealing to her, I would think, in a fairly intimate way.
I wonder in that context how much the McCain strategy of going after Obama for redistributing the wealth might blow up in his face, because if somebody's economically strapped, they'd be in favor of redistributing the wealth.
I would have thought so, and I would think that negative campaigning would blow up in your face, too.
Yeah. It's going to be very interesting. Next Tuesday is going to be a very interesting day.
Oh.
Yeah. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, Everything You Know Is Wrong.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you know, and sometimes even everything you think you know is, as the Fireside Theater says, wrong. Yeah.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Former Lutheran pastor and psychologist Dr. Ken Olson is with us. Trafford.com, his website. In honor of Halloween coming up this Friday, he has a new book out, Satan's Influence on America's History, the subject of his new book, An Exposé of Satan's Schemes. Dr. Ken Olson, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm playing this as if it were tongue-in-cheek, but you're writing this book in a fairly straightforward fashion, are you not?
That's right.
Okay, so if I were to acknowledge that it is possible for Satan to possess somebody, and that person were to take power in the United States, I would think that what that person would do would be to start shredding the Constitution, destroying our civil liberties, declare a war that leads to the death of at least 100,000, maybe as many as a million innocent people, noncombatants. That puts 4.5 million people into refugee status, that throws at least 500,000 young women and girls in nearby countries into forced prostitution just in order literally to feed themselves to survive. This is what George Bush has done. Is it possible that George W. Bush is satanic?
Well, I don't have any information about that, but what you're quoting really is the Council on Foreign Relationships, which they have in their bylaws that they're to replace the Constitution of the United States, eliminate the Bill of Rights, and work towards the New World Order, period.
Are you sure of that? I've read some of the documents that have to do with the CFR, and I can't say that I've read their Constitution all the way through. In fact, I'm not sure they have one. I think they have Articles of Incorporation and bylaws. But I've never seen anything like that. Can you give me a citation?
Well, I don't have it right here with me.
Okay.
But I'm not making...
You suggest in your book the secret societies like the Illuminati, the Freemasons, the Committee of 300, the CFR that you just mentioned, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers, the Club of Rome, and the New Age movement are planning to launch World War III and give rise to the New World Order. It seems to me like it's been more the neoconservatives who've been trying to do this.
Well,
who are members of none of the above.
One of the things that we don't know, even the Illuminati does not know, is that there are two higher groups of Satanism called the World Council of 13 and the UCAW Council of 13, which regularly meets with Satan. And then they give the orders down through the different organizations of what they're to do. And I never planned on being an exorcist, but the Lord called me into it since 1982. And he also has sent to me since 1987 satanic ritual abuse survivors. Uh-huh. And through their healing and through their process of what they're recalling of what they've been told, I've learned an awful lot that you can't learn in a book.
Yeah, we're talking with Dr. Ken Olson, his book, An Exposé of Satan's Schemes. Dr. Olson, the five-pointed star, as it appears on our flag, is generally acknowledged to be a fairly positive symbol. It's kind of like Leonardo da Vinci's man, yeah, you know, with the head at the top and the arms on the two sides and the legs at the bottom. When you flip that five-pointed star upside down, the pointy part is on the bottom. It's like the beard on the goat. The two points on the top are like the horns of the goat, and the two points on the side are like the ears of the goat. It becomes the symbol of Satan. Am I right on that?
That's correct.
Then why did the Republican Party in the year 2000 on their logo, and you can see this at GOP.com, I mean, you can go right to the Republican Party site and see it. They did this the year that George Bush took over the party. Why did they flip the stars upside down on their logo?
Well, that I don't know, but what you're saying is absolutely true about the inversion of the star, and it really is also a picture of a Baphomet, who is another name for Satan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, you know, one of the things I know people who are serious believers who are very concerned that they think that the Republican Party has been taken over by Satanists, and that the head Satanist is George W. Bush, who has done nothing but leave death and destruction behind him. I mean, 1,800 people dead in New Orleans while he went off to eat cake with John McCain in Arizona. It just Dick Cheney, you know, hiding out in his bunker and snarling at people and lurking around. I would think that for somebody like yourself who is involved in things like exorcisms, and then, you know, Sarah Palin bringing a witch doctor from Africa to pray over her, don't these things concern you about the Republican Party?
Well, it also concerns me by the fact that Obama and Hillary Clinton were invited to the Bilderbergers meeting.
Yeah, although the Bilderbergers meeting is, you know, I mean, a lot of people went to that. That's kind of the big shots who run the world. You're convinced that that's also a satanic group.
Yes, it is. And they elected Clinton president before he was even nominated in the United States. So that's a little bit of power.
Yeah. So,
and what I find, and the thing that's discouraging to me, the deeper I get into this shadow government, if you please,
right,
the people who are really running and calling the shots, it's not a matter of Democrats or Republicans, but it's a matter of who sold out to Satan. And we're talking about very powerful people.
Yeah. Who do you now? You know, I mean, you're going after Obama and Clinton. I'm going after Bush. Do we have a political divide between the two of us, Dr. Olson?
No, because Bush was a part of the, you know, when he went through the rituals when he was
in Skull and Bones.
Yeah, Skull and Bones.
Yeah, so you're suggesting that might have been when Satan took over George Bush when he was 19 or 20 years old and joined Skull and Bones?
Well, that's an opening. You know, Satan is always looking for openings in people.
Well, and his father went through that ritual. In fact, his grandfather was the one who stole, was it Geronimo's skull? It was one of the famous Native American,
right,
you know, and took it to Connecticut for the Skull and Bones Society.
So maybe
what we're looking at here is multi-generational Satanism in the House of Bush.
Well, you could name other houses, too.
For example?
Well, like the Rockefellers.
So, well, you know, John D. was a pretty rich guy and I'd say a pretty creepy businessman. He delighted in putting his small competitors out of business. When did he sell out?
Well, when Jacob Schiff came over from the, he was from Germany and he was raised in the Rothschild home. He came over to do a number on America. One would be to get elected people to the Supreme Court, to infiltrate the Christian churches through the seminaries, and to create race problems between the blacks and the whites. And, you know, the sad thing about it, he achieved a lot of his stuff. And you'd be surprised how many in seminaries, they don't even believe in Satan.
Yeah. Well, I know that. There are many, many religious people who think that Satan is a metaphor, and frankly, I consider myself among them. We part company on this, but respectfully. We're talking with Dr. Ken Olson, his book, An Exposé of Satan's Scheme. We have just 1 minute left, Dr. Olson.
Okay,
should Americans do?
Well,
in your
what I'm saying is that we need to have a spiritual revival of Christianity. And Satan
just Christianity? I mean, isn't this something that transcends the religions? I mean, isn't this, don't we need a spiritual revival in all religions in the world?
Yes. And Satan's been very real to me since he's tried to kill me a couple times.
I see.
I had two women, one from Dallas, call me up and say God woke her up and said Satan's trying to kill Ken, and a satanic ritual abuse multiple in Scottsdale who I'd worked with had the same experience. And what are you going to do when you find out Satan's going to kill you? And so,
I think you'd start praying seriously.
Yeah.
You would start praying seriously. Dr. Ken Olson, his website, trafford.com, his book, An Exposé of Satan's Schemes. An interesting conversation, Dr. Olson. Thank you for joining us
today. Thank you so much for having me.
The week of Halloween here on Friday, I guess, All Hallows Eve. 16 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, Larry Scott. Let's go from the... from the strange to the quite normal, VAWatchdog.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain. The Tom Hartman Program. Although it does not lead to stiff thinking. Well, maybe it does. Larry Scott on the line with us. He's the founder and editor of the nation's premier veterans organization's website. If you or anybody in your family or anybody you know are a veteran, get over to VAWatchdog.org now. Larry, the VA going on a privatization binge?
It appears that way, Tom.
This is the remnant of satanic Republicans running the VA?
You know what I think? I think this is a last push effort by this administration and perhaps Dr. James Peake, the VA secretary, to try to push this through. We just got word in from the office of Senator Daniel Akaka, who is chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, and that he and Senator Rockefeller of West Virginia, who's a member of the committee, have gotten a hold of an internal VA document, and they are not happy campers. They're demanding answers from the VA. The document proposes to stop construction or completely do away with 22 VA facilities, go out and lease space, and then privatize the health care at those facilities.
Whoa.
We don't know what the facilities are. They're being kind of quiet about how they got this document or what the document actually says. So right now, they're just making public that there is a plan to privatize health care, it appears, at 22 VA facilities around the country. They're angry. They want answers. I know we'll be hearing more about this in the very near future. I don't even have this up on the site yet. It'll be up a little later. It just came in a few minutes ago.
Yeah. You heard it here, folks. Breaking news. I mean, this is, you know, John McCain trying to justify privatizing Social Security, which he ran on for years and years and years. George W. Bush, of course, unsuccessfully ran for the House of Representatives in 1977 from Texas on that. These guys, there's nothing they ever saw that they didn't think could and should be done by one of their cronies who can make some money off the public till.
And John McCain wants to do what he calls his VA card, where veterans can take a card and take it anywhere. The problem with that is if they do that, you're going to end up with privatized VA health care. The fewer veterans that use the system, the weaker the system becomes, fewer employees, closed facilities.
Right.
And, of course, the most ridiculous thing, Tom, it's going to cost the government more.
Right. Privatized, because you got a bunch of McCain cronies in there sticking their hand in their till. You know, they've got to pay dividends to their shareholders.
And exactly right. And it is absolutely a ridiculous plan.
Yeah. Incredible. So we're talking with Larry Scott, the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, VAWatchdog.org, of course, the website. The Shredder scandal at the VA. Tell me about this, Larry.
Well, it has taken off. We talked about it just a little bit a couple of weeks ago, and this is a story that we broke here at VAWatchdog.org, and that is that some investigators for the VA's Office of Inspector General found critical documents and shredders at VA regional offices around the country. The 57 regional offices handle veterans' claims, perhaps a disability, a pension, or widow's benefit, something like that. We started looking into it and found it was a lot more than that. After the story broke, the VA came out and literally shut down their regional offices. They did a dumpster dive, cleaned out all shredder bins, they stopped shredding, and actually ordered personal shredders to be taken away from employees that they keep at their desk. When that search was done, it took about 3 days, they reported back to the VA. They found more than 500 critical documents in shredder bins around the country. Each of those documents was critical to a veteran's claim. Had the shredder gone on, that claim would have been delayed or more than likely denied. Now, the Office of Inspector General is doing further investigation on this, but this is a tip of the iceberg story. It's not just shredded documents, but it's mishandled documents. There were some ongoing investigations or new investigations popping up. We found some incredible things at the New York Regional Office in New York City. They found 20,000 pieces of unopened mail. 20,000, and this is one of 57 offices. They went in, they at that time, they removed the top six managers. They put them on administrative leave, you know, pending action against them. They brought in people from the VA, and they started sorting that mail, opening it, and trying to get it into the system. The problem this brings up is if we have 20,000 pieces of unopened mail at one regional office, what's going on at the other regional offices? If at one point in time, when the VA says, stop shredding, clean out the bins, we want to know what you have. If at that snapshot in time, Tom, we have 500 critical documents, what about the day before? What about the week before, the month before, the year before? I think you get the picture. There is an incredible problem inside the VA with handling of documents, what they call a timeliness issue, getting the documents open, getting them to the claim, and then what happens afterwards. It is absolutely getting out of hand. There are the VA is going to brief the service organizations this Friday in a face-to-face conference in Washington, D.C. We'll know more about this situation at that time.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Now, the good news, I guess, Larry, and by the way, I think you just in a few seconds you need to say why this is not an argument for privatization of the VA. It's an argument for better oversight. I guess I just said it. But the good news is that the VA may be able to help some folks who are having troubles with their mortgages.
Yeah, very quickly, Tom, the VA does not underwrite subprime loans. However, they do have new refinancing programs so that some veterans who could have been caught in the subprime mess may be able to refinance through the VA. All the information's on the site.
Great news. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Get over there, check it out. Thanks, Larry, for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, Ellen Brown, Web of Debt.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Brings
sickness and take all our land. Chase us and kill us when we take a stand. The red on the flag is our blood. See, I'm American too. In the hold of a ship, my ancestors came, torn from their homes and sold off as slaves. We built up this country at the end of a chain, and many have died for our rights. See, I'm American too. I dream of a time in the land of the free. We all belong and this country believes. We can let go the distance between you and me. Oh, I'm American too. Yeah, hey,
5 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to Teamster.org for more information. What if the stock market, we saw the stock market over the last couple of days go up rather precipitously, and we've seen the price of gold go down as much as $60 in one day, in fact, in 1 hour, in an hour in which nothing appeared to be going on in the world that would justify that. What if there is not so much, you know, in the context of our first guest, Ken Olson, you know, some satanic plot behind the whole thing that is flipping the stars upside down in the GOP logo, but actually kind of a out in the open conspiracy, as it were, to manipulate the economy and perhaps even for political purposes. I don't know. We'll see. Ellen Brown is she's an attorney. She's the author of Web of Debt. Webofdebt.com is her website, as well as the title of her book. And some of her writings, I think, have been absolutely brilliant. I've found tremendous resonance with them. And, Ellen, I don't have any idea what your politics are, but I trust your economics. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. My politics are like yours.
Oh, okay. It's very often you find people who are outing the Fed, basically, and proponents of gold that are very, very conservative. But nonetheless, it doesn't matter. I mean, you know, we have people on this show from every part of the spectrum. You have an article recently about the plunge protection team that blew my mind. And rather than trying to tell my listeners about it, I wanted you to come on and talk about it. Let me just set this up, and this is something that goes beyond your article. This is what immediately came to my mind. I'm in the middle of reading right now a book called The Day the Bubble Burst, which was published back in 1979 and was written throughout the 60s and 70s by, you know, first-person interviews with people who were there in 1929 and the subsequent years. And one of the points that they make in the book is that although the market crashed in 29 and in 1930 and 31 and even 32, things were pretty bad, it really fell apart after Hoover left office, because to a certain extent, Andrew Mellon, the Secretary of the Treasury, had his own informal plunge protection team with a bunch of big bankers and financiers in New York who were doing their best to hold things together. And when Roosevelt was elected, they just said, ah, to hell with it. And, you know, let's make the Democrat look bad. And the bottom really fell out. And that's when the bank started failing, was right after Roosevelt took power, in large part because they stopped manipulating the market, as it were, to the extent that they could. And I'm wondering if we're maybe even seeing something like that being played out. Tell us what the plunge protection team is, what we're seeing them do apparently right now, and what it might mean.
There definitely is a plunge protection team. The official name of it is the President's Working Group on Financial Markets. It was set up by presidential order under President Reagan in 1988 following the collapse in 1987. And it says right in the order that the purpose is to maintain market stability, and it's to use the Treasury's resources to do it, which means taxpayer money is going to keep the market stable.
To buy and sell stocks in the market in a way that's not transparent in order to manipulate the market, basically.
Right. What they do is they buy stock futures and to try and set it. Often, you know, you think the market's going to go way down in the morning and you see that the futures are up. Well, how can that be? You know, why did sentiment suddenly change? But the futures market is very small, so it's quite easy to manipulate. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't work, for instance, yesterday, that 900-point rise was unbelievable. I mean, there was nothing happened to explain that. the CNBC commentators were, first of all, it was only the last 2 hours of the day, so it wasn't anything that had happened all day long. In fact, the market was tending to sink before that. And then suddenly it shot up 900 points, and then on CNBC they were saying this was in anticipation of a rate cut, and because investors were, had just seen the bottom and saw all these bargains and had just jumped in for
the
bargain.
But the rate cut happened today, and the market's down 107 points right now.
Exactly, and the rate cut had been talked about before. It wasn't like suddenly, it was only a rumor. It wasn't like suddenly they announced that they were actually having a rate cut.
Right.
Plus, the rate cut is just not going to fix the problem. It's not even, I mean, it's a trickle. The problem is the credit freeze, and it's not because the Fed funds rate is too high. In fact, it's way, way low.
Mm-hmm. So, and the LIBOR rate is still pushing 3%, as I recall, the London interbank offering. In other words, the credit markets are still pretty locked up, and the banks are taking all this taxpayer money and using it to buy other banks rather than to loan money to people. I mean, it's just totally bizarre. But back to the plunge protection team. So this group is made up of the president, the secretary of the treasury, the chairman of the Fed, and who am I missing? There's two others.
There's the SEC, head of the SEC, the head of the Commodities Bureau,
exchange
whatever
Commission.
That's called.
Yeah, the Commodities
Exchange the FTC or something. And and then there are major banks that are there, I understand.
Oh, really?
Show up. And they're the ones that actually execute the plan.
Right. And so Reagan put this into place after the big crash of 87 in order to stabilize markets. Do you think it's possible that the plunge protection team is – first of all, what's the evidence that the plunge protection team is involving itself in driving down the price of gold, down the price of oil – I was predicting back, by the way, a year ago that in the 2 weeks before the election, we'd see gasoline. Forget about the price of gasoline. It'll be under $3 because you've got a Republican as president and you've got a Republican running for president. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is going to be a gift from the oil companies and the Republican administration.
Right.
And sure enough, here we are. Is this the plunge protection team, the president's office, manipulating the markets, both the commodities markets and the stock market?
I believe so. There was Don Cox is a strategist for the Bank of Montreal, and he stated that what happened was this huge manipulation back in July, and that's when things were really going the other way. That gold was over, had broken through $1,000 an ounce, and oil was over $140 a barrel, and the dollar was just going down, down, down,
right.
And so. The central banks got to, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were about to go bankrupt. So the central banks got together and they agreed to manipulate the dollar up. So they would buy dollars and sell euros and yen. And so there was this dramatic reversal in the dollar, and there was no logical reason why that should be. And then meanwhile, gold went suddenly dropped off a cliff, and oil dropped off a cliff. So oil is down to, I mean, it dropped by 50%.
Yeah, because they're countercyclical with the dollar. Now, when if the fundamentals are that we're now $10 trillion in debt, which is more than 50% of the entire GDP of the United States, we're adding $2 trillion of debt this year. The M3 is off the scale. They've stopped publishing it, the rate at which the money supply is being inflated. I think probably anybody rational would look at this and say, we're not looking at a Great Depression deflation. We may over the short term, over the next 6, 8, 10, 12 months, but over the long term, over the next 3 or 4 years, we're looking at a Weimar Republic inflation. In 1919, it took 8 Deutschmarks to buy $1. And by 1923, it took 3.4 billion Deutschmarks to buy $1. And it seems to me that that's the direction we're going. And yet we're seeing the opposite happen right now, both in the commodities market and the stock market. Are you, first of all, do you think that my analysis is right? And secondly, if it is, then I would project that in the weeks and months following the election, pretty much regardless of who gets elected, but particularly if it's a Democrat as president, then the plunge protection team is going to say, okay, all bets are off. We're going to walk away, and we're going to just dump this whole thing into this guy's lap.
I would agree. That's likely. an interesting thing about the Weimar inflation, that was actually caused by the banks. It was, people think that it was the government that was madly printing money, but it was the banks that were madly printing money. The Reichsbank at that time was privately owned,
right,
just like the U.S. Federal Reserve, and they were responding to short sellers who were madly selling the mark because the country was so heavily in debt, it was obvious that the mark was losing value. So they were massively short selling, which meant they needed the marks to...
They needed marks to cover it.
Yeah.
They had 300 paper factories feeding 4,000 printing companies running Reichsmarks continuously. It was just amazing. We're talking with Ellen Brown. We just have a minute left, Ellen. Webofdebt.com is her website. It's brilliant. Her newest article about the plunge protection team. What is your guess of what's going to happen over the next year?
Well, if you look at Germany, it went absolutely bankrupt. And then the way Hitler turned it around was he issued his own money. And I think that's the only solution, is to give the money issuing power back to the government. And
for the Treasury Department to buy the Fed.
Right. If the Federal Reserve were actually nationalized, rather than having to monetize government debt, putting us more into debt every time they make a loan, they could actually issue credit outright. They could issue the full faith and credit of the United States.
I agree. I've been calling for that for some time, in fact, that we need to federalize the debt, or federalize the Fed, rather, and thus federalize the debt as well. Ellen Brown, webofdebt.com, a brilliant website. Check it out. Ellen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
45 minutes past.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you lost Iraq. So I'm taking my
got to do this. We must take our country back, and we are going to do it. One Senate seat at a time, one president at a time, one House of Representatives seat at a time, one member of the Assembly of California, one member of state legislatures all across the United States at a time. Today, the candidate that we would like to highlight for your consideration, Russ Warner, warnerforcongress.com is the website. He's running for Congress, the United States Congress, in California's 26th district against incumbent Republican David Dreyer, the guy who used to be all over cable TV for years and years and has been pretty much invisible, I think, since he was outed as being gay. But he's still there, and he's still got a lot of power. David Dreyer is running a pretty strong campaign. Russ Warner is going to try and take him on. Russ Warner, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you, Tom? It's an honor to be here.
Thank you, Russ. It's great to have you with us. The website, warnerforcongress.com. Tell us, what the California's 26th district, where is this physically?
It's up against the foothills. It goes from La Cañada, Flint Ridge, Montrose, La Quinceta to Rancho Cucamonga. And it also incorporates Walnut, San Marino, and Arcadia. It's a very long district, but it's a great district, and I'm going to be proud to represent it in Washington.
This is in Southern California?
Yes, Southern California.
Yeah, so the south of L.A., would it be?
It's more east of L.A.
East of L.A.
And I can tell you that, David Dreyer has been there for 28 years, and he's never had a challenger like me to go after him before.
Yeah.
And the reason I decided to go after, and just to let you know, Tom, and everyone out there, I've never run for public office before. I am a true grassroots candidate. And I'm running because my son Greg proudly served his country in Iraq for 17 months. And when he came home, he goes, Dad, there's something wrong. Would you run for Congress? Well, I never thought I'd be doing anything like this, but we put together one heck of a race. But I'll tell you, it's what really changed my life was the day that my son Greg called me on a cell phone from Baghdad. And in the middle of our conversation, I heard people yelling and screaming and gunfire. That's what motivated me to really do what I'm doing right now. This country is in a lot of trouble, and yeah, we have to take it back. And it's one house at a time, one state senate seat, one mayor seat, one water district. These guys are bad.
Right. And David Dreyer has been right in there with the Republicans all along, you know, voting absolutely in lockstep, maybe not absolutely, but largely in lockstep with George W. Bush. In fact, he was for years the main go-to guy to have on TV to promote Republican policies. And I'm really impressed that you're willing and able to take him on, Russ Warner. We're talking with Russ Warner, the candidate for Congress, for the United States Congress from California's 26th District. His website, warnerforcongress.com. You're a successful small businessman. That's your background?
That's right. I started the old-fashioned way, working 15, 16 hours a day for over 10 years, with hardly a day off. And I'm able to live the American dream, take care of my family, and pay back the country I love so much by running for Congress. And, you know, Congress is all about just everyday people going back there to represent their district and to take their ideas and their values and their work ethics back. And, right now Congress doesn't have that. There's a lot of career politicians back there, and David Dreyer being one of them. And, yes, he voted 94% of the time with the Bush administration, a true rubber stamp. And when he was chairman of the Rules Committee, he changed the rules so this administration could push through their agenda of corruption. He's as responsible as anyone in Washington right now in the Bush administration as to what's going wrong in this country today.
So if you want to influence a race, if you want to help flip another red seat blue, get over to Warner for Congress, F-O-R Congress, warnerforcongress.com, and toss a few bucks Russ Warner's way. And if you're in the district, I'm sure your contact information is there so people can offer to volunteer and help out.
Oh, absolutely. It's there. We've got a lot of support in this district. This is the best congressional race this district's seen in a long, long, long time.
Russ Warner, what are the major issues in your mind of this campaign? What are the things that significantly differentiate you from David Dreyer?
Well, just a few months ago, David Dreyer was quoted as saying we need to support our troops by letting them finish their mission. It was never their mission. This was the most ill-conceived war that this nation's ever gotten itself into. And as I describe it, this administration under Bush literally wrapped themselves in God, country, and the American flag and then misled us to vote against our own rights. And that's why we're in this predicament. It's getting our troops out of Iraq, bringing them home responsibly. It's also about the economy. Under the Bush administration, we've become a corporate welfare nation. And it's a sad state today that our children and our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren are going to be paying for what just happened a few months ago when the corporations in this country literally robbed us blind of $700 billion.
Yeah, they stuck a gun to their own head and said, give us money or we'll shoot.
That's exactly what they did, and it's not over yet.
Yeah. No, I agree. In fact, I would say it hasn't even really fully begun. I think we're just looking at the very beginnings of this thing, and we need a good, strong Democratic Congress to support a good, strong Democratic president to make this happen. We're talking with Russ Warner, warnerforcongress.com. Get over to that website and offer to help out if you can, if you're in the district, or toss some money their way. Russ Warner, affordable health care, this is a big issue for you?
Oh, absolutely. I grew up in a poor family, and I know what it's like for the families, mothers and fathers around there to argue about taking their children to the doctor because in 1958, my dad brought home about $60 a week, and there were six of us.
Wow.
If you were to spend an extra $7 or $8 to take someone to the doctor, that was a big chunk out of the family money. I mean, it hurt.
So Russ Warner is the man. Warner for Congress is the website, and warnerforcongress.com is the website. Russ, good luck.
Okay, Tom, I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for being with us. Tomorrow, Dick Patton, president of the American Family Business Institute, and Governor Janet Napolitano will be here. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.